Season 2 of Robbie the Robot's Waiting is still a week or so away, but unlike popular darts game show Bullseye, there's no way we were going to let you leave empty-handed. Speedboat or no speedboat. There's that, and there's the realisation that, after our post-season 1 hiatus, we've all absorbed so much new sci-fi and fantasy that it would be impossible to cram it all into one episode. So, here is our elegantly titled What We've Been Watching and or Reading Special Edition, an exciting adventure through what's been keeping our eyeballs happy and possibly sad in April and May. Hi Dave, hi Tanavi.
Hey, hi guys. Hi everyone.
So, one of the best places to start, I reckon, Shadow and Bone, which has been one of the most talked about new TV shows the past few weeks. It's on Netflix and it's epic fantasy, but it's really not The Witcher, right?
Absolutely not. No, very different. Very different. I think it's got more in common with his Dark Materials, really, just in terms of the sort of the essence of it and the kind of presentation of it and the busyness of it. Tanavi, have you seen it?
I have, and I really liked it, even though I guess, Dave, you are the fantasy man, but I really enjoyed it. The fantasy is not always my cup of tea, but this one, it was more sort of action, adventure, and it had, I think, like you said, less like The Witcher, it had a bit of more of a general appeal. It had a storyline where it was obviously, you know, giving us the origin of this Grishaverse, but you didn't need to have read the books or know about it. It kind of explained it as it went, and the visuals are stunning, as you'd expect from Netflix. And so I think there's quite a lot in there. There's the romance side of it, there's the kind of mythology side of it, there's some great sort of villains and monsters and magic and all of that. So there's something for everyone, basically, and they did it well.
They did. It's this very, very detailed, very, very lush, detailed environment, and kind of unique as well. I mean, it's based on the young adult novels by Leigh Bardugo, and yeah, the Grisha, the Grishaverse is called the Grisha novel trilogy. Grishas are kind of magic users in this world, right? And what I like about it is it's got this kind of quite distinctive Russian inspired setting there. It feels like Imperial Russia, kind of Europe at the height of the great game, but with this magical rift. Instead of an iron curtain, there's a curtain of darkness, right, between Ravka, right, the Russian states, and so to speak, and the West. So it's kind of an interesting just to see something different. Oh, you know, we've got quite a lot of fantasy on Netflix, from Cursed to The Witcher and The Irregulars. In fact, in some respects, this is a little bit more like The Irregulars than something that's kind of big swords and sorcery like The Witcher. It's much more kind of city based. There are firearms in this, and ships and trains and things. It's kind of a much more of a sort of later fantasy. But it actually took me a couple of episodes to get into it. It was very busy at first, I thought. Lots of different perspectives, one side of the rift, the other side of the rift. Didn't quite gel with the characters, except for the lead is Jessie May Lee, and she plays Alina Starkov, who's the main viewpoint character, and she's a delight from the start. But it switches perspective quite a lot at first, and it actually took me a couple of episodes to get into it. But then as soon as really they kind of get into the intrigue and her relationship with General Kerrigan, who's played by Ben Barnes, you might remember from like The Punisher and so on, then I was hooked.
Is it something that you see having potential? Because, I mean, obviously there are a lot of books that Leigh Bardugo's written. Can you see this going on for, you know, numerous seasons?
Yeah, I think so. It has a satisfactory arc this first season. It certainly has a climax, but it leaves with enough threads loose that you want to see what happens next, and you kind of want to follow it. There's a couple of sort of subplots that haven't resolved, but you can see them coming together. Just sort of characters who are following slightly different arcs. Right at the end, they're all on this kind of ship, just kind of on the run from what's happened. And although it has kind of concluded a little bit of a saga there, I'm trying to avoid spoilers for you, but am I doing quite a good job, Tanavi? I'm trying not to say, well, at the end, you kind of go, oh, right, okay, it's all going to kick off again. So yeah, there's definitely potential for more.
Yeah, I think that's the point, is that in a way you feel like you're watching about five or six different stories, because exactly, you've got the crows, which are this kind of sort of gangsterish type of crew, yeah, who are sort of looking for Alina for their own sort of gain. Then you've got obviously Alina and her sort of connection with her old sort of history. So that's Mal, her sort of childhood friend. And then the kind of new sort of story coming together with General Kerrigan. Then you've also got people, like random people, like a Nina, who's a heart render, and you sort of see her kind of like loosely tied to a couple of the people in the plot, but having her own story as well. I'm still not entirely sure why they had that focus on her, but I'm sure that the point of that is that we get to know her before her sort of storyline takes off a bit more. Yeah. And then you've got, obviously the kind of mythology of it, like the fold itself and the Volcra and the sort of storytelling about where that came from. And then even if you guessed who the villain was, which I don't think was that difficult.
It's not that hard, considering he's like called the Dark One or something.
I know.
He's never going to be anything but the villain, right?
Right.
Isn't he in Time Bandits? Okay, I can't remember.
He's Prince Caspian, right?
He is Prince Caspian, yeah. Exactly. So, good old Ben Barnes. Yeah, like I said, and he's the villain in Punisher as well, isn't he? He's got this sort of... He's kind of good-looking or menacing, depending on what angle he's filmed at.
I think it's good. It's very true, and it works really well for this character. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've also got flashbacks and things like that. So it does feel like very various storylines, but as you said, they do come together sort of loosely at the end, and it does feel like they're setting up for quite a few more stories, or at least, tying up a few storylines. They also, I have to say, like watching it, I agree with you that Alina is a great character and Jessie Maylie does a great job portraying her, but they, she does make some questionable decisions and you have to be like, really, would you do that? And things like that. But then at the same time, then you remember these are like young people and they're, sort of making decisions that are emotional, and also they're in a situation where, any of us would be really scared, never mind trying to figure out what to do. We'd just probably just be like, cacking our pants probably.
Yeah. She's at the Tsar's court at one point, isn't she? Which has got to be intimidating.
I know. But even just getting on, going through the fold, I mean, my God, the idea of literally going somewhere where you can't see anything and all you know there are monsters around you is just a terrifying thought. So
it plays the darkness very well, yeah.
It does. And that metaphor between darkness and light and between, good and bad and all the kind of fantasy elements that they use sort of in symbiosis, really.
Yeah.
I think they do it very well. So it's not a perfect watch, but it's really intriguing. And even if you don't like fantasy, I think this is a good one to view.
It feels more sophisticated than something like The Irregulars. It feels like it's got a more unusual setting than something like The Witcher. So I think this has come out pretty well from it. I would say to some people to spot in this, I don't know whether you notice this, there's some big name and actors in it, right? Like Zoe Wanamaker's in it. But Luke Pasqualino is a character in it. He doesn't really say very much. And I watch it going,
no.
Is that... It is, isn't it? It's D'Artagnan and Adama
exactly
from because he's so kind of understated in it, and he's I'm assuming he's going to become a more important role later. I was looking at it for ages, going, that guy in the big Russian hat, I definitely know him.
Yeah,
and Kevin Eldon's in this as well. There's a few people like that. Kevin Eldon's in there as this sort of spiritual advisor, this kind of librarian kind of character, and he's I'm so used to seeing him in kind of comedies, this sort of very kind of alien character actor that he is. He plays kind of very comedic, physically comedic roles often. And he's sort of in this as this sort of slightly creepy librarian character. That's Kevin Eldon. I've seen him live on stage. So there's some odd people in it. Yeah, it's great.
And I think that actually is testament to the actors, but also it's kind of a nice choice. They haven't taken necessarily big names. They've taken people who sort of fit the roles and so it is a little bit like try and spot someone, but most of the people that are in it, I don't recognize at all. So I'm sort of seeing them just really as their characters. Yeah.
I mean, from what you've said, I think one of the most interesting things about it seems to be the setting, because I think certainly on TV and in movies, the idea of fantasy is very much, let's create a medieval sort of European world.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And actually a lot of fiction now is taking inspiration from loads more sort of places. And I think the idea that this is sort of looking at Russia really sounds like it feels a bit different. Also, fantasy doesn't have to be set sort of in the pre-industrial age.
Exactly. It's so refreshing to see fantasy that has firearms in it and just people with guns and trains and things. I think that's interesting. It feels quite Pratchett-like sometimes.
It's a bit steampunk, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
From fantasy onto a show which is fairly close to reality, I talked about For All Mankind briefly a few weeks ago. And Dave, you've bought an iPhone. That's reason enough to have Apple TV Plus. And you've sort of been smitten with For All Mankind, right?
Oh my God, it's my new favorite thing. I cannot express enough how you all have to go out and watch For All Mankind. In fact, Apple TV Plus, it wasn't on my radar as a service to get. You know, we've spoken about this before on the show, how many services there are, and I've already got Netflix and so on. So I wasn't lining up to it. And you're absolutely right, Rich. You can get Apple TV Plus free with kit that you get from Apple, and there's loads of offers on. It's worth shopping around. And so I got it. And so far, everything I've seen on there has been extremely high quality. There's not as much on there for free as there is in some other services. But what is there is great. I mean, Ted Lasso's on there, which is fantastic comedy. There's just a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. The Morning Show and things. And they've just launched a Mosquito Coast TV show, which, you know, is getting mixed reviews, but it's very well made. And they've got For All Mankind, which is my new favorite thing. Right, it's amazing. There's two seasons of it there. I've absolutely just binged it, and I cannot recommend it enough. Oh my God! You're right, Rich. You have spoken this on the show before, but just to briefly recap, it's Ronald D. Moore, who we know from creating Battlestar Galactica, and with that, there's echoes of that in some of the space scenes, but it's set in a fictional version of the space race, which is like ours, but it diverts at the point where America kind of loses its bottle at that crunch point and doesn't land on the moon before Russia. Russia beat them to the moon in July 1969.
Interestingly about that, Ronald D. Moore actually said that there is a moment that they've identified where things diverge. Right. And there's actually a Russian scientist who was really key to their space program who died a couple of years before the moon landing. And actually that their suggestion is that he lived, and that was the reason that they sort of got there first. They've not ever been able to deal with that in the show, because you can't really say, oh, well, this guy's alive, but in a parallel universe,
exactly.
He wasn't. But in their heads, that's where that history bifurcates.
It's absolutely fascinating. And it's interesting because the show is sort of, I think, in sort of, there's sort of three components to it. It's one third soap opera. I mean, there are entire episodes just set with the families of the astronauts and their lives and loves and losses. And that's great. It's really well acted and well made. And it's just a period piece, right? So it's in the, first of all, the sort of 60s and 70s and 80s and so on. That's great. And then there's sort of a third of it. It's like the West Wing. It's all the politics and what the president wants. And they use lots of archive footage and stuff as well. And that's interesting because that starts to creep apart from the real world as well. It's interesting just what the effect not winning the space race has on the American psyche in this show. And things like they leave Vietnam 5 years earlier than they do in the real world. And it's not a big thing. It just happens in the background. And there's just all these things happening. And that's great. And then, of course, a third of it is space. And that's like watching Apollo 13. Just amazing just stuff. And you see that Battlestar Galactica, like those sort of crash zooms as the camera focuses on a ship desperately trying to lock onto it as it's doing weird things in the atmosphere. And that's just amazing. So exhilarating. So, yeah, I'm just fascinated. It's just an alternative vision of the 70s and 80s. Great characters, really well acted, really intense. You can just get into it watching the sort of affairs and the loves and the deaths of the people. And then they just have these incredible moments where they're just trying to rescue somebody in space. And it's just pure adrenaline filled science fiction as these ships are as time passes better than we have in the real world because of certain things that have happened, investments that have been made and things. Mm-hmm. And I love it. I'm so exhilarated by it. You know, it's like, so far I would recommend it to people who are fans of Battlestar Galactica. I mean, you've said as much on the show before, I think, Rich, right? I mean, you loved it too.
Yeah. When I spoke about it before, I was still in season one. And I think season two is really interesting progression on from that. Season one's quite right stuffy.
Yeah.
Though it's sort of got elements of moon landing and Apollo, you know, it moves on a little bit. But season two, they've gone forward to 1983 and there's like a big base on the moon, space shuttles going up. You know, going to space has become routine.
Yeah.
But not in the kind of, oh, we're bored of this, let's stop doing it. You know, the Russians have a base on the moon, the Americans have a base on the moon, and it's kind of a new frontier of the Cold War.
Yeah. Oh,
and it plays out brilliantly. You know, it's so tense. But then, as Dave says, you've got the spaceships. And I think there's just something, I guess, magical about real spaceships where they can't suddenly go to warp. They can't do everything in the atmosphere. They have to plan everything miles ahead. If someone gets blown out of an airlock, they're not coming back.
You know,
the
you know, there's not that easy sort of, oh, let's rescue people or let's find out what's going on with our tricorders. Everything has to be worked for. And, you know, space is really dangerous. And then there's there is that whole politics.
Yeah.
And you can totally, I think, because it's kind of based on real history, but just nudged a little bit to the side, you know, the little things like, in this universe, John Lennon survives. And it is these little things. Oh, it's just slightly different, but not very different. And you know, technology has moved on a bit because the space race is so much more important here.
Right.
And they've had to invent new things. You know, video calls have already become.
They've got Deepmail or whatever they call it in the earlier. But on that note, not just the technology, Rich. One of the things I quite like about it is that. The society has moved on more subtly, and this is an interesting point. The show is called For All Mankind, which is genuinely, of course, the phrase that was used of the 1969 mission. But it feels unnecessarily gendered today. But there's a big thing there, because actually in the real world, this is a real thing that happened. The first woman in space, who was Russian, made a point that America prided itself on being this great progressive democracy, but of course had terrible race relations, and they didn't have a female astronaut and that kind of thing. And that was a point that the Russians made at the time. So in this, the world of this series, they've had to make strides. They've had to kind of examine that situation more. And so actually a lot of it is about the women who work at NASA having to step to the front. And a lot of the viewpoint characters are women who, again, this is genuinely true. There was a Mercury program for female astronauts that never came to anything in the real world. And in this, it does, because they have to. They're sort of forced by politics and circumstance to accelerate the female astronaut program. And so For All Mankind actually becomes a show often about what the female NASA employees are doing and thinking. And I sort of love that about it as well. It's sort of very subtly about the sort of social changes that happen because of that sort of space race thing. And Ronald D. Moore does know how to do a space scene. The only thing that I said, I watched it all the way through and I loved it. I genuinely did. I definitely watch it. I thought that as it gets into season two and there's more going on the moon, it gets a little bit more techno babble. Of course, Ronald D. Moore also wrote for Star Trek, and there are just moments where it's a bit kind of, oh, we have to couple the reactor to this and throw a switch and go, oh, okay. Reverse the polarity type of it. There's a few more moments like that as it goes on, but forgivable.
I guess
forgivable.
It's more sci-fi, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's just more sci-fi now.
You've progressed more away from the real world. So I think it's a really interesting show, and I'm really interested to see what they do in season three.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Sticking in the real end of sci-fi, I've been reading Andy Weir's new book. So the guy who wrote The Martian, he's back with Project Hail Mary, which is great. I absolutely loved it. It's set in the very near future, like really near. And the idea is that these microorganisms called astrophage are basically consuming the sun. So the sun is cooling down. And in like decades, there is going to be no Earth because the sun isn't going to be hot enough. So Earth has to put together this kind of last-ditch mission to work out how to stop the astrophage and travel off to another star where there's something going on that sort of seems to mirror what's happening with our sun and kind of get to the bottom of it. But as you'd expect from the guy who wrote The Martian, it's all about sciencing the shit out of stuff. the main character is nowhere near as likable as Mark Watney. I mean, you know, especially when you watch Matt Damon in the movie, he's just inspiring because it's just like, yeah, I'm not going to let my head drop. I'm just going to work all this stuff out. And this guy has the sort of science angle the same way, and he's always trying to sort of work things out. But he's kind of reluctant to be where he is on this sort of spaceship, on this one-way mission. And you gradually learn more about him as the book goes on because he's lost his memory at the beginning, and he gradually pieces things together. All he can remember is the science, and he's gradually having to sort of piece everything together. But what makes it particularly interesting is that there is an alien, and it's not a massive spoiler to say that he meets an alien who is having exactly the same problem, and they're there for the same reasons. But it's not like meeting Spock or a Klingon who looks a lot like this. Is a seriously weird alien, looks completely different atmosphere, you know, atmosphere that would just wipe us out straight away. Language works in a completely different way of eating food. Everything is different. And a lot of it is about how they sort of come to communicate with one another, but also, and do so by shared knowledge of science, all the sort of things that are consistent. And then this working out what this astrophage is, how they stop it. And it's kind of like, it's like a science fiction novel that doesn't have kind of magic solutions. Everything is about thinking about. Now, the astrophage is a little bit sort of conveniently magic because as well as wiping out the Earth, it makes close to speed of light travel possible. But at the same time, you have to deal with the effects of relativity. So it's not, you know, all good. I just thought it was a really good sort of merging of science and fiction. I would really, really recommend it.
Okay, I'll check that out. And this is a sort of return to form because he's written one novel between this and The Martian, hasn't he?
I don't think Artemis, all that I think it was.
Right, yeah.
It's called Artemis and it was set on the moon. You know, it's a crime novel that could have been set anywhere, but it's on the moon. I mean, again, it's got quite scientific elements. I think he's a writer who doesn't write female characters as well as he writes men. And I mean, that's a fairly common thing you can say of a lot of authors, but he doesn't quite nail the lead character in that as well as he does here, right, and did in The Martian, I think. And as well, it's just, I think his strengths are someone on their own with their thoughts and sort of working stuff out and sort of almost showing you're working.
Yeah.
And you could say that's a fairly limiting sort of speciality, but he's managed to make a book here that follows that kind of structure, but is completely different to The Martian.
Wow. Okay.
Well, I think that means, you know, he's obviously taken the element that really worked in The Martian and applied it again and again showed his working. I think that there's something about that I find really, really impressive. The fact that you're not just explaining it away with, you know, magic, that you're actually figuring out a way that makes sense, that makes us almost feel like we could, you know, that we could do that. You don't need anything else. You just need your brain to kind of be in that situation and do it. And I think that's fantastic.
Well, I think in the same way that For All Mankind does, you know, this isn't requiring a massive leap of science.
Yeah.
To get, you know, it has required the whole of humanity to almost pull together, you know, drafting people with no choice to sort of bring technology, commandeering huge areas of the Sahara Desert to actually grow this astrophage so they can actually travel across the universe. But it's not like, oh, Zefram Cochrane suddenly appeared and we've got a warp drive. You know, it's not that simple. You know, everything has to be done over a long period of time and planned.
Yeah.
Big change of tone now. Everyone's seen The Mitchells versus the Machines, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Dog, pig, loaf of bread.
Well, I always get those things confused. How great was this film?
Yeah, really good. Really good. Just loads of fun. You know, it's from Miller and Lord, who are, you know, are famous from the Lego movies, amongst other things. You know, they're not directing this, they are producing though. They've got a very frenetic tone to them, haven't they? I just think this is loads of fun. It's got a lot of heart and it's just very exciting.
Well, I think that's the thing, isn't it? They just throw everything at the screen. And I think that's what I loved about it. It's fast. You know, sometimes you're just, how am I keeping up with all this? And then it's not just what's happening on screen. It's almost like the imagination and sort of notes written on the screen, what people are thinking. Mm. It's just brilliant. And sort of an as apocalyptic end of the world, robots have taken over. It's kind of how to do the Terminator for families.
Yeah.
You know, the robots don't want to kill everyone. They put you in your own little pod where you can just sit watching TV for all eternity. Obviously blasted into space and it's kind of like, is technology a good or a bad thing? And actually, it doesn't really come down and say, yeah, technology is awful. It's just how you use it. So
yeah. Did you enjoy it, Tanami?
I did. And there's definitely, you know, it is a family animation. I think it has got something for everyone. There are some digs in there about, you know, how we use technology and how the corporations are stealing our data and giving it to AI and what could possibly go wrong, and then showing maybe a robot apocalypse. But yes, there is that definitely that sort of topical sort of dig at big corporations and things. But at the heart of it is the heart of the family. And I think everybody knows people like the Mitchells. That's kind of what makes it extra fun, really. And like the dad who really wants to engage his kids, but they're not interested in his woodwork, you know, like it's just things like that. And, you know, and like how the daughter doesn't necessarily understand him and things like that. But it's when it comes to the crunch, like they're all sort of there for each other in their funny, weird ways. And it's kind of genius in the way that they use the characters. I love the way they use the dog. My God, it's amazing. Yes.
just to confuse the AI picture capture.
I know, I don't want to spoil it, but it is brilliant how everybody in their own weird way is useful. And sometimes that uniqueness is what helps them survive. Yeah. And I think that's not a bad lesson at all. But the way that they sort of portray that is just hilarious. So it's fun.
I mean, those two robots that get disconnected from the whole and they sort of scribble faces on themselves. So, yeah, we are human.
Yeah.
they're amongst the funniest things, yeah.
And the Furbies going psycho.
Oh my God.
Furbies. That mall scene with the psycho Furbies is definitely a highlight of the year for Rare Images. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Let the dark harvest begin.
I know.
my favorite joke actually.
Yeah.
It's basically a riff on a Dalek gag, but where you've got the Hoovers, robot Hoovers coming down the escalator, just gets them tumbled out.
Yeah. I think there's lots of moments in there that will hit your funny bone, depending on your, you know, certain temperament. But it is that thing where it's just, there's quite a bit of silliness, but at the same time, I think there are like clever references subtly in there as well. And it felt a bit, to me, it felt a bit 80s. I don't know why, but like just some of the way that I, maybe like the colouring and the...
It's got a really interesting colour palette, hasn't it? It's really vibrant, yeah.
I mean, and how much was Olivia Colman enjoying being the villain?
Olivia Colman as a murderous Siri, I think is probably her next Oscar, isn't it? I imagine.
I hope so.
It bugged me though.
This is why we all have to be nice to Alexa.
But it did bug me though the whole time, because I was like, I know that voice, and I had to wait till the credits to figure out it was Olivia Colman. Yeah. But she's good. But I have to say, it does, I suppose, postulate an interesting concept that we do almost use our phones like they're a member of our family, you know, we do so much with them, but at the same time it's really easy to chuck them in the bin and get something better. And so it's like, if your phone had feelings, how would you treat it? Should we be better people just in general?
I think Empire's review made a very good point when it compared it to Into the Spider-Verse. I mean, I know there's the Lord Miller connection, but I think both films are really trying to kind of push the envelope of animation, you know, and not to diss Pixar at all, because I love Pixar, but you know, you know kind of what you're getting with a Pixar film, but this actually felt like it was pushing the envelope just in terms of how you tell a story and, you know, bringing stuff from people's imagination, doing things that aren't at all realistic and just being, I guess, mad and just having a load of ideas and just seeing what works.
Yeah, the way that young people interact with, you know, with images and social media and things. This movie broke the fourth wall to throw filters, you know, kind of TikTok filters on top of the images and so on. I thought that was quite fun and quite an interesting use of the way that we tell stories to each other these days.
And it was clever as well, because it had that, the reactions of, you know, the kids going, well, yeah, this is totally hilarious. And dad's going, what is this craziness that I do not understand? And I know I very much have been in that situation where I'm like, I don't know why this is supposed to be funny. This is kind of creepy to me. And I don't understand how you've managed to do these things. And even how she, and the fact that she's using family videos, but sort of animating those within the animation and that kind of thing is it highlights the difference between different people and how they react to those things. And it's so sweet how essentially when it came in the crisis, dad's hardest moment was having to learn how to use the computer and YouTube. And it was just, oh my God, it was adorable. but he succeeded. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, The Mitchells versus the Machines is one of Netflix's mission to make a movie every single week, or put out a movie every single week. And another was Love and Monsters, which I think you've seen, Tanavi.
I did. I really enjoyed it. It was, you know, again, one sort of made for the family, or, you know, sort of a YA tool, I guess. Yeah. And it's about a guy called Joel, played by Dylan O'Brien, who finds himself, unfortunately, just with a group of sort of random strangers in the middle of this apocalypse where, I guess, not too estranged from reality. That, I mean, it could possibly happen, where they have a nuclear holocaust, basically. And what happens is the all their sort of animals basically mutate from radiation, and then it leaves the humans mainly living sort of underground, but in these sort of small colonies, without any sort of real way of sort of communicating with each other. And so Joel, a very sweet, I guess, a pacifist who who really freezes at the sight of danger and therefore can't really help anyone in the colony when it comes to defending, is sort of made to be the chef in this bunker. And he doesn't, he's the only single person in there as well. So after about 7 years, this guy's like, right, I want to go find my girlfriend. And he sets off bravely, but possibly also quite stupidly, across the wastelands to go find her. And along the way, he meets some cool characters like Michael Rooker, who plays Clyde, who's this kind of, I suppose, if you see, ever seen those sort of doomsday prepper kind of guys?
Yeah, he's
got one of those, and he's in his element, basically.
He's the perfect actor for that.
Isn't he? Oh, he's the best. He's just the best. I mean, it's just genius casting with him. Yeah, and so you find these people, and you kind of, you know, expect it to be a sort of Disney-esque feeling at the end where, you know, he finds the girl and everything's good, but it doesn't quite end like that, which is, I think a nicer way in a sense. And he gets to learn on the way sort of how to be brave and how to, you know, be the hero when he's sort of been used to sort of being cooped up as the chef. But yeah, so it's done well. It's got some interesting characters, and it's a fun, like, hour and 40 minutes, certainly.
Quick quiz question. What is the biggest film at the box office since the pandemic began?
I don't know.
Tenet.
Nope.
Wonder Woman.
Nope. Think
Have
Hero.
Been in the other
think
films?
Bigger Heroes. Think Bigger Heroes.
Kong and Kong versus the Godzilla.
Yeah.
Well, okay, no way.
Yeah, which I did actually see. I didn't see it at the cinema. I saw it on TV. I can't remember very much about it. I thought it was okay. I thought the ending was quite disappointing when Kong and Godzilla stopped fighting when they realized their parents were both called Martha.
Amazing.
That took me completely out of it. I kind of admire this film, though. I mean, I say it's a solid 3 stars, but I think any film that has so much contempt for anyone human, because it's so geared towards like big monsters, you know, humans have dialogue, yeah, whatever, you're just sort of waiting for this sort of massive smackdown. Why are they fighting? I don't know. Why can't they be friends? I don't know. But to be fair, it absolutely loves Godzilla and Kong lore and pulls in quite a lot of elements, and it does work in that whole MonsterVerse setting. So it, you know, follows on from the first Godzilla I thought was fine, the Gareth Edwards one. Wasn't so keen on the second one, King of the Monsters. See, and Kong Skull Island I thought was okay. So, you know, it's as sort of shared universes go, I think it's been quite successful. I mean, obviously it's not Marvel, but I think they have kind of pulled the strands together, and they do know that the stars are the big monsters,
right? Yeah. So the
There's
action
no about that.
Is worth it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see skyscraper-sized monsters smashing into skyscrapers, yeah, this is the movie for you. If you want dialogue and interesting character development, it's probably not the film for you. But, you know, if you go and see a film called Godzilla vs. Kong, I mean, you can't say they haven't told you what you're getting.
Yeah. What's it about? Oh, Godzilla vs. Kong. The title.
Yeah. Oh, he's playing an arcade game. He's playing Donkey Kong with his tiny little dinosaur arms.
What service is it on, Rich? Can I watch it today?
I think I watched it on Amazon and I had to pay to watch it.
Gotcha.
And you have to pay a premium rate. I was writing something about it, so I paid the money. I try to see as many big, stupid blockbusters as I can.
Yeah, yeah.
And this kind of fit the bill on that regard.
Okay,
I think
great.
You can access it through Sky Box Office as well, I think.
Right, yeah. Okay. It's basically a premium, and I suspect it will go sort of cheaper onto the sort of the movie platforms fairly soon.
Gotcha.
I mean, in the States, you can watch it on HBO Max, but that's because in the States, they're doing the simultaneous release between all Warner movies and HBO Max.
Right.
I feel bad about this, but every time I see anything with Godzilla, I have to compare it to the Chewits adverts. Which is a real throwback. I'm sorry, there are probably quite a few listeners out there who don't know what I'm talking about, but look it up.
Well, Adam, in one of the behind-the-scenes documentaries, Adam Wingard, the director, kept going on about Chewits and how it inspired the film.
Seriously? Well, there you go. So this is the one to compare then. Okay, good.
Sorry, I did just totally make that up.
Did you?
I mean, come on, the little rappers would have got in the way of the camera.
Oh, man, you totally got me then. I can't believe I believed you for that moment.
Well, Chewits are very influential, you know.
I can't help it. That was like my first, like always, that's like my first Godzilla sort of recognition. I think weirdly, I can't help it. See, this is what I'm telling about. It's my, when I can be like, I'm not well, it's fine.
Tanavi, I think you've been watching Jupiter's Legacy, which is Netflix's new big superhero show. They bought Mark Miller's Millerworld a few years ago, and this is the first thing they've made based on that. What do you think of it?
Do you know what, honestly, I only watched like half an hour, so I feel a bit bad talking about it.
Is that because you just ran out of time or because you just didn't enjoy it? I mean, did you quit? Did you rage quit or did you just run out of time?
A bit of both. I don't know. I just wasn't feeling it when I started watching. And I think also like it was a bit, I think I wanted something that I thought would be a bit like of a, I don't know why, for whatever reason, a bit more kind of Love and Monsters-esque, like not quite as sort of intense, an afternoon watch. And actually, it did have quite a lot of action and sort of scenes with stuff like, you know, hitting the screen almost. But yeah, so I think I just couldn't get into it in that moment. And I kind of decided I'd look for something else to watch. But yeah, sorry, Rich.
Well, I've watched three episodes of it and it hasn't quite grabbed me yet. I think it's quite serious. Where it takes itself quite seriously. I think it's an interesting idea, the idea that you've got basically Superman, Wonder Woman, these great superheroes who are revered, have been for decades, but their kids are struggling with how to live up to the family name, which is, you know, has potential. It does a lot in flashbacks, so you see the origins of Utopian, who's like the Superman figure, and the other main characters, sort of back in sort of Depression era. It's one of these where you're kind of constantly piecing together, you know, from past and present, who these characters are, how they all interact, and all that. And there's interesting stuff in there, but I don't know. I was wondering at one point, is it just because it's not like DC or Marvel heroes that I don't recognize? Yeah. And I thought, well, I absolutely adore the Umbrella Academy and I really like The Boys. And, you know, and again, The Boys is riffing on real superheroes and recognizable superheroes. But I think The Boys is doing it in such an over the top, funny, clever, let's just push all the boundaries kind of way that it just feels different. Whereas this could almost be, sort of DC, one of the dark DC movies, just with characters you don't recognize. I'm going to stick with it. I hope it kind of kicks into gear, but it's not grabbed me yet.
Mm. Yeah, fair enough.
I think you're right. I think it, just from starting to watch it, I'm not sure exactly what I was hoping for, but it did feel like it did take itself a bit seriously. And so that's, I think for me, that kind of stopped me from getting into it a bit. But I think with all those as well, like generally I just enjoy superhero stuff. Yeah. And maybe I've just been spoiled because, you know, when it comes to like the, you know, the movies and you got, you know, Marvel and everything, it's just so amazing. But even TV, Arrowverse and everything, you know, it's done well. You enjoy it. And even when they introduce new characters or, you know, they're usually superheroes I've never heard of. So I'm kind of willing to give them a chance, but maybe I'm just comparing them a bit too much and expecting a bit too much.
Oh, you wait till the Suicide Squad comes along. There are some crazy superheroes and villains in that, by the looks of things.
Yeah.
That I am looking forward to.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And about 100 of them as well in that movie.
And they're all going to die, apparently. Yeah. James Gunn can just kill anyone he wants, so he says. So.
Brilliant. Mm.
Speaking of superheroes, Dave, you've rewatched Green Lantern.
I have. It's...
It wasn't in Deadpool 2, didn't Deadpool kill Ryan Reynolds before he made Green Lantern? So does that film still exist?
It does still exist. It's currently on, it is on, I think it's on Sky Cinema, right? So you can get it through Now TV is where I watched it. So I have seen it before. I saw it when I came out and it's not great. You know, the Zack Snyder's Justice League again and a load of DC movies since, I sort of was intrigued to go back and watch it. What sort of got me thinking about it was that in the Zack Snyder cut of Justice League, there is a Green Lantern at the beginning fighting alongside the Amazons and so on. And also there was, I don't know whether you knew this, but the role played by Martian Manhunter in that film was originally going to be a Green Lantern at the end who approaches Batman. In one of the early versions, the script was going to be a Green Lantern coming to Earth to talk about that.
Right.
And that was replaced with Martian Manhunter because there was some, you know, DC wanted to do some other stuff with Green Lanterns. So knowing all about this, I wanted to see it again. And it turns out my other half had never seen the Green Lantern film. So we thought we'd throw it on because it's on Sky Cinema and watch it. And it's such a shame because there are moments of it where it's not terrible, and you kind of, starting, I was like, oh, this is interesting. This could be DC's answer to Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, it's got this big sort of this space. It's a very sort of space opera kind of thing. There's this big story, and Green Lanterns themselves as this kind of these intergalactic peacekeepers are quite interesting, and it just doesn't deliver. It just doesn't deliver. Ryan Reynolds throughout, you just think he's, you know, he's just Deadpool. And there's a line in it quite early on when he's, you know, he's a test pilot. It's not where he plays Hal Jordan as a test pilot, where a stuffy character at the base says to him, "Watch your back, Hal." And he just goes, "That's impossible, Bob." And it's just, it's so snide. And you just think, oh, he's just, what, he's wasted doing this. He's just this kind of just mouthy character that is perfect for Deadpool and also like the characters like he plays in Hobbs and Shaw. So, it's just not right. It's sort of chirpy and it's fun. There's some interesting things about it that I'd forgotten. So interesting seeing, again, I'd forgotten that some people were in it. Taika Waititi is a main character in it. He's the sidekick character, which I sort of forgot. Affecting really? An American accent. Yeah, really affecting an American accent. Well. He's Hal Jordan's mate at the base, who was the first person who sees him in the Green Lantern thing. And I'd forgotten that. He plays the character Thomas that Hal Jordan, Green Lantern, calls the first time he encounters the alien ring. And I'd forgotten that was the case. And of course, he's such a great actor and a great filmmaker. And we know him from Thor, Ragnarok, and so on. And I was like, oh yeah, it's him in this. And so there's so many things about it. Temuera Morrison, Boba Fett, is in it as Green Lantern Abin Sur. We've got Peter Sarsgaard as the villain. Also, you know, Angela Bassett is in it as a Amanda Waller. A version of that character is also in Suicide Squad, different, played by a different actor. But she's in it, and you're kind of going, this has a lot of components in it. Tim Robbins is in it. And you think, how did that guy get talked into doing this? There's so many components in it that ought to be brilliant. The rest is, unfortunately, it's just a mess.
Well, a really good director. I mean, Martin Campbell did GoldenEye, did Casino Royale, he did Mark of Zorro. Yep. I mean, that might be the New Zealand connection, why Taika Waititi and Tamara Morrison are in. But yeah, I mean, he's a seriously good action director.
Yeah.
And I don't think he ever got it right in this film. I mean,
No, it's just
really innovative suit as well, because it was one of the first kind of entirely CG suits. It wasn't Ryan Reynolds in Lycra. It was, Ryan Reynolds in a magic glowy suit.
Magic glowy suit.
It's visually interesting. I think.
The visions of Oa and the Green Lantern's base is interesting. It's unfortunately it's just paced wrong. It's a bit of a mess. It's kind of it just crams too much in there. It doesn't do any of it justice. But it's a real shame because the description of it makes it sound like it's going to be great fun, and unfortunately it isn't.
I think that's the funny thing about it. It's like it must take a particularly terrible sort of script and sort of production to take all these really great elements and make them all awful, like all the actors and the story and everything. And it's funny because when you first started saying that you were sort of comparing it to the sort of DC movies, I thought, are you trying to see if it's really as terrible as all them, or does it look actually better compared to like Superman versus Batman.
It's kind of sad because, it's almost more like it wouldn't take much of a push to make this more like Shazam or something like that. That was a little bit more playful. That's the thing. Yeah. It's kind of so, I don't know. Anyway, so I rewatched that. And that's, if you want to catch up on that, that's on Sky Cinema at the moment.
Now, when we had the WhatsApps going around to discuss what was going to be in this episode, I was a little bit taken aback when, Tanavi, you mentioned the words flash forward and Terra Nova.
Yeah.
Two shows from about a decade ago that lasted a season apiece.
Yeah.
And my first thing I wanted to chat was, why?
I know, right? It's a funny one. I was kind of browsing on Disney Plus, and so it came up, I think after, I can't remember if it was after I'd watched Falcon the Winter Soldier or something like that. And I suddenly thought, I was like, I don't know what this one's about. And
was it like you've watched this, maybe you'll like? And
yes.
If so, can they sue?
Yeah. But that was the funny thing, is that I started watching Terra Nova and didn't have any idea about it, what it was really going to be about, or sort of about the production of it or anything. And turned out I really quite liked it. And it's, I think, a 2010 series, and it features Jason O'Mara and Shelley Khan. And basically, it's set in a futuristic world where we have once again destroyed the planet. And so, the air on Earth's terrible, people can't breathe, there's nowhere to live, there's no food, there's you're not allowed to have more than two children because obviously there's no resources. But in this terrible time, they discover a portal that seems to open intermittently and allows people to go back in time to the Jurassic period. And so they've started letting, in a kind of lottery type thing, but also like selecting, clever people, scientists, engineers, etc., to go back and basically make a new colony, but in, centuries earlier, millions of years earlier. And so it's got a lot of it stems around this main sort of family of five who have an illegal child, hence there's five of them, and they managed to make it to Terra Nova in the Jurassic period, and then it's once they're there, they're sort of trying to survive not only against the creatures out there and the dinosaurs, but also the humans, because you find out no matter where humans are, there's still murder, there's still a power struggle, there's still sort of jealousy and all that kind of stuff. So each episode almost feels fairly standalone, and I kind of got into it quite quickly. I thought the casting was really good. It turns out that it was a Brandon Braga show, and I do tend to like his stuff. And then that's kind of what, and actually at the end of it, it does kind of wrap up, although they leave a slight cliffhanger there as to what could happen next, but it kind of closes up fairly well. Like, it ends a chapter, I guess. And then after that, Disney Plus then recommended Flash Forward, which is another Brandon Braga series. So I was like, David Goyer.
The Dark Knight, yeah.
That's right. And so, and that one I had heard of, and I think I'd watched when it sort of first came out, had watched a couple of episodes, but for whatever reason, hadn't sort of followed through on that. And yeah, so then I got into that as well. And I love the premise of that there's a day when seemingly everybody in the world blacks out at exactly the same time for 2 hours and like 13 seconds or something, 17 seconds. And sorry, two minutes and 17 seconds or something like that. And they have to figure out how and why and all the rest of it. And it centers around Joseph Fiennes playing a slightly unconvincing FBI agent. Definitely was better in Shakespeare in Love. But it's intriguing, and it's got like people like John Cho in there. And he's so good as his part, Joseph Fiennes' partner. And yeah, and it's really interesting because it really makes you think about what would you do if you kind of knew your future, but you weren't sure it was your future, but you know, if it was a terrible future, how would you change it? And it's really interesting as to what those kind of blackouts, which aren't actually blackouts, people see their future in those times, what it does to you in the present.
Now, I remember it coming out, and it was very much touted as the new Lost.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, and it's exactly. Like, oh, look, here is a mystery show.
Yeah.
There was a few of these, wasn't there? In the sort of shadow of Lost, as you say, you mentioned Terra Nova, but we had Flash Forward, there was Alcatraz, do you remember that? And there was just a few shows that were basically really high concept. Like they thought that, I guess, that what made Lost was the premise rather than the characters. And so these shows, I remember watching and sort of enjoying Flash Forward, but the concept was doing all the heavy lifting, right? I don't think I ever cared that much about the characters.
Yeah, I think as well that
that's right.
Yeah. You could see a lot of the aftermath of Lost in it as well, because, you know, the big thing about Lost was like, we're not getting any answers. It was like question.
Yeah.
And here you could tell that they were trying to make sure we are seeding some answers relatively early on. I'd not really thought about the show until you mentioned it.
It's funny because I do remember the show. I haven't seen it for ages.
Services.
yeah. There's a couple of interesting things about it. I don't know how much of it you got through, but one thing I do remember about it is, it just to echo what you said there, Tanavi, about the premise and what would you do if you had these flash forwards, was the first episode, I think, was called No More Good Days, which I just love as a title for something that's about the Vision, which is great. And the other thing is there's an episode, I think it might be three or four, I forget, you've seen it more recently than I have, which plays Björk's It's So Quiet, and at the start, and it's a vision of what happens when everyone blacks out, and a bus kind of quietly just goes off the road into a lake, and there's just stuff happening, and it's just while playing this music, and I thought that what a fantastically well filmed choreographed just piece of setup. There's nothing, you know, it's just this music and this vision of the world falling apart. Unfortunately, when it kind of dives down into the kind of character moments, I kind of dug it less. But those kind of, that scene stuck with me. It certainly knew how to intrigue, if nothing else.
Absolutely, it's very artistic, and it tells the story through so many different pairs of eyes, right? So you see all these people experiencing the same moment in different ways, and also what it does to them, and. Yeah, and you don't, I guess we'll never know necessarily like how it all connected to them. But
I'm pretty sure it was Dominic Monaghan, that Hobbit. Yeah. I think he wrecked everything.
Bad Hobbit, yeah. Yeah. But it's, yeah, I think, I mean, I got into it for sure, and so I was kind of surprised that it only had one season. But I think there's kind of high concept sort of shows as well. I'm trying to think of when like the last one was that I'd watched like that, and yeah, I can't really remember now.
No, there was a real, it felt like there was a real drive for shows like that for a while, and we haven't had that so much since.
And has anyone watched The Bad Batch yet?
I haven't. I've taken the opportunity to be inspired by that to catch up on the Star Wars animation that I haven't seen. So I know that it can be watched on its own, but I desperately want to finish Clone Wars and then Rebels. So I'm binging that and going to catch up afterwards. What do you make of it?
It's very much the Clone Wars season 7.5. And big fan of the Clone Wars, and I think the last season of the Clone Wars is great. The way it sort of plays into the end of Revenge of the Sith, and you see all the events of Revenge of the Sith from a different perspective, is brilliant. And you see the Order 66 from a different angle. Love that. And also season 7 introduces the Bad Batch, who are a bunch of clones who are a bit different. They're not like the other clones. They all have different skills. You've got Wrecker, who's like really big and strong. You've got Tech, who's a genius hunter, who's kind of, I think his skill is that he's sensitive and he feels things more than everybody else. But, you know, every group like this has to have someone sensitive. And then there's Crosshair, who's like the assassin. And then there is Echo, who was an ordinary clone, but he was captured by the separatists and all sorts of experiments done on him. He was used as like a tactical computer. And so he's kind of broken by that. So he's joined this group. And this kind of picks up with them. Well, it kind of picks up at Order 66. That's where the show starts. And so you're actually seeing the beginnings of the Empire from this kind of rogue group of clones. And because they are different, they don't follow through on Order 66. So they kind of sort of go back with the other clones, like, what is going on? And they kind of end up going on the run. And this is kind of the first time Star Wars has really looked at this period. We know that the Emperor has taken over. We know that something, you know, the galaxy is going to have to go through quite a few changes to get us to the point we are at the point of A New Hope. But, you know, this sort of time immediately after Revenge of the Sith hasn't really been dealt with. And actually it's an interesting setting because, you know, you've got characters like Tarkin coming in and saying, yeah, do we really need clones? Why don't we start having conscripted soldiers? So we've got stormtroopers, and you're sort of setting up that universe. Now, I don't think it's really exploded into life yet. It's decent without being amazing. The characters are okay. And, you know, full marks to Dee Bradley Baker, who voices all of them.
Wow.
Switches between them like constantly. And they've all got different voices, but you can hear the hints of the clones in them, which, you know, it's really clever in that regard. And, you know, it feels like Star Wars, and you really get a sense that there's an arc sort of building. They've also met up with another clone, but it's a female clone because all the other clones are male. This kind of this sort of, it's like My Five Dads. So they're sort of taking this clone and look after her. It's got potential, but they haven't really, they're a group of characters we don't really know yet. So it's not like you're rooting for them in the way that you might. Speaking of Rebels, there is a brilliant nod to that show at the beginning of The Bad Batch, because when Order 66 takes place, you actually see the kid who grows up to become Kanan Jarrus, the Jedi in that, sort of going on the run. Right. You sort of see how he sort of comes, which I thought was a really nice twist, because he's got a different name here. And it's like, hang on, I recognize that name. You know, you dive into Wikipedia and you're like, aha!
Yeah.
But, you know, it's nice to have Star Wars on TV. And, you know, I genuinely believe that TV is kind of the future of Star Wars, because I think, you know, no one's judging it against the original trilogy in quite the same way that they do with the movies.
Yeah, very true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's enough on that. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Yeah, very nice to see you. So we'll be back sometime before the end of May, when the Rewind topic will be Highlander, because there can be only one. Until then, remember, you can't beat a bit of Bully.